This is Kurt Benrud for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to our program. We're reading from Ernest Gaines' novel, A Lesson Before Dying. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience and will be made available in podcast after the broadcast. We're pleased to present these dramatic readings of A Lesson Before Dying using a cast of volunteer readers. Feel free to call us at 919-832-5138 with any comments or questions. That number again is 919-832-5138.
She went into the living room, and I heard her at the telephone, speaking to Dora. Then I heard her hang up the telephone and go into the kitchen. I sat on the bed with my head bowed and my left hand holding the towel in place. I didn't dare look in the mirror again. I glanced over my shoulder toward the window on the other side of the bed, and I could see through the curtain that it was nearly dark outside. I got up from the bed and went through the living room and back into the kitchen. I could smell the red beans warming on the stove. I couldn't smell the rice. You don't smell rice unless it's burning. And I didn't smell pork chops, either. Vivian was at the sink, making a salad. I went up to her and put my right arm around her waist while my left hand held the towel on my head. "What are you doing, honey?" She knew I could see what she was doing, so she didn't answer me. "Still mad, huh?" "I'm not mad. You still love me?" She didn't answer. I kissed her on the jaw. She went on making the salad. "Do you want to know what happened today, honey?" "I already know what happened today," she said. "At the jail, I mean." She went on with her salad. Now she was slicing up a cucumber to add to the lettuce and tomato. "It went well today, honey. It went very well. He and I walked around the room while I talked to him. Then we ate. His Nana was so proud. I brought him the pencil and notepad I told you about. It went good today, honey. Aren't you proud?" She put the sliced cucumber into the bowl and cut up tomato and the lettuce, and then she added oil and vinegar. She took the salad to the table. She dished up the rice and spread beans over the rice and placed a pork chop on each plate. She brought the two plates to the table and sat down. I sat opposite her. "You want me to ask the blessing, honey?" She didn't answer. I bowed my head and made the sign of the cross and asked God to bless the food. I looked up at her and started eating. She was not eating. "Still mad, huh?" "I'm just thinking," she said. I ate and looked at her. "I heard from him," she said. "He won't give me a divorce unless he can see his children every weekend." My head started throbbing again. "When did you hear from him?" "Yesterday. I was going to tell you today when I saw you." "He's still in Texas?" "Yes." "And I suppose he's heard about us." "I suppose so." "And that's to keep us from going away?" "I suppose so." "Son of a bitch," I said. "All of a sudden he needs to see his children every weekend?" I put down my fork. I didn't feel like eating any more. "I'm going to leave," I said. "You don't have to. I don't want to give him any more fuel to work with." "Suit yourself." "Don't you think it's best?" "It doesn't matter," she said. "We get hurt no matter what happens." She picked at her food, but she didn't eat. I sat there looking at her. "I need you to stand with me. He's got only a few more weeks. I need you now more than ever." She didn't answer. She held the fork in her hand, but she did not bring it up to her mouth. "Well, I better go," I said. She didn't look at me. "Honey, suppose someone said something about you. Would you want me to just walk away?" Again, nothing from her. "Honey, you have anything in here to drink?" I asked her. "Bottle in the cabinet," she said. "Honey, you gonna fix me a drink?" She didn't move. I got up from the table and got the bottle of Old Forester out of the cabinet. It was 3/4 full. "You want one, honey?" "No." I poured myself a double, then I added some water from the pitcher in the refrigerator. "Still mad, huh?" I said, after I sat down. "Never was mad, just disgusted." "About the same thing," I said. "I'll finish my drink and leave." That's up to you. I love you, honey. I need you, but I'm only human. One day I'll bring flowers to the graveyard, she said. That's not you talking, honey. No, she said, looking up at me. She had been holding it in a long time, and now she was going to let it out. I saw it coming as soon as she spoke. What is me? She said. Tell me, what is me? Honey? No, tell me. Who am I? Who are you? Who are we? Tell me. All I know is I love you, I said. That's not enough, she said. What is love? Honey, what is it? She said. That bed? That's love? Honey, please, no. Give me some answers. Give me some answers today. I want answers. Honey, I love you. No, that's no answer. I don't know what you mean by love. That bed? The cane field? What's love? Tell me what love is. I didn't know what to say. Nothing I would say was going to change anything. I'll leave, I said. Sure, that's the easy way out. Leave. Well, what do you want? What the hell do you want from me? What the hell do you want from me? I don't know what the others want. I just want something I don't have. I've done my best, I said. No, you have not, she said. In bed for a few moments is not enough. Is that all I've ever given you? Is that all? What else? Any consideration? I got up from the table. I jerked the towel from my head and slammed it down on my plate. You can have your goddamn red beans and rice and towel and everything else. Damn this shit. I went to the front door and jerked it open, and there was the screen. And through the screen, I could see outside into the darkness, and I didn't want to go out there. There was nothing outside this house that I cared for. Not school, not home, not my aunt, not the quarter, not anything else in the world. I don't know how long I stood there looking out into the darkness. A couple of minutes, I suppose. Then I went back into the kitchen. I knelt down and buried my face in her lap.
Chapter 27. After church, minister came back to the house with my aunt, Miss Eloise, Miss Emma, and Inez for coffee and cake. I lay across the bed in my room, looking out the window at the stack of bean poles in the garden. Far back as I could remember, my aunt would pull up the rows of poles at the end of each season and stack them in that same corner of the garden until a new crop of beans was ready to be poled. Beyond the poles, on the other side of the road, I could see the tops of the pecan trees in Farrell Giroux's backyard. The trees had begun to bud again. The buds looked black from this distance. I could see above the trees how heavy, low, and gray the sky was. I had intended to go for a drive, but I was afraid it might rain while I was gone, making the road too muddy for me to drive back down the quarter. Anyway, I had work to do. But as usual, I ended up doing only a little because of the singing and praying coming up from the church. After Tante Lou and her company had been at the house a while, she came into my room. "You sleep?" she asked. "I'm awake. Reverend Ambrose like to talk to you." "What about?" I lay on my back, gazing up at the ceiling, my hands clasped behind my head so that my arms stuck out, forming a cross. "I done told you that's bad luck," my aunt said. Without shifting my eyes from the ceiling, I unclasped my hands from behind my head and clasped them on my chest. Tante Lou stood there looking at me. "He can come in?" "Sure, he can come in." "You gonna put your shoes and tuck in that shirt?" she asked. "I'll put on my shoes and tuck in my shirt," I said. She stood there, watching me a while. Then she left the room. I sat up on the bed and passed my hands over my face. When the minister came into the room, I had tucked in my shirt and put on my shoes, and I was standing at the window looking out at the garden. My aunt had prepared a half dozen rows about 30 feet long for spring planting. She would start a planting the week after Easter if the ground was dry enough. The minister stood behind me, and I turned from the window to look at him. "Care to sit down, Reverend?" There were only two chairs in the room, the one at my desk and rocker by the fireplace. "You going to sit down?" he asked me. "I don't mind standing." He looked at my desk. "I see you've been working." I tried to. Afraid I didn't get much done. He sat down in the chair and looked up at me. "They learning anything?" "I do my best, Reverend." He nodded his bald head. "I do the same. My best." My back to the window, I waited to hear what he wanted to talk to me about. He looked down at his hands and rubbed them together. For a man his size, he had really big hands. He rubbed them again, raising his eyes to me. "They ain't much time." "Jefferson?" "Yes." "3 weeks. Not quite." "Minus a couple days," I said. He nodded his head, a small, tired little man. He had preached a long sermon today, and it showed in his face. "He ain't saved." "I can't help you there, Reverend." "That's where you're wrong. He listened to you." I turned my back on him and looked out on the garden. "You ever think of anybody else but yourself?" I didn't answer him. "I ask you, you ever think of anybody but yourself?" "I have my work to do, Reverend. You have yours," I said without looking around at him. "Mine is reading, writing, and arithmetic. Yours is saving souls." "He don't need no more reading, writing, and arithmetic." "That's where you come in, Reverend." I stared beyond the garden, toward the budding pecan trees in Farrell DeRoe's backyard. The sky was so low the trees seemed nearly to touch it. "When are you going back?" Reverend Ambrose asked behind me. "I don't know. One day next week, I suppose." "And what you going to talk about?" "I don't know, Reverend." "I'm going back with Sis Emma tomorrow. I'm going to talk about God." "I'm sure he needs to hear that, Reverend." "You sure you are?" "Maybe not. Maybe I'm not sure about anything." "I know I'm sure," he said. "Yes, I know I'm sure." I looked out the newly turned rows of earth, and I wished I could just lie down between the rows and not hear and not be a part of any of this. This is a mean world, but there is a better one. I wish to prepare him for that better world, but I need your help. I don't believe in that other world, Reverend. Don't believe in God. I believe in God, Reverend, I said, looking beyond the rows of turned-up earth toward the budding pecan trees across the road. I believe in God. Every day of my life, I believe in God. Just not that other world. I didn't answer him. Now could they go on? You ever thought about that? I looked at the buds on the trees, and I did not answer him. Well, he said to my back. I turned from the window and looked at him, where he sat at my desk. School papers, notebooks, textbooks, and pencils were spread out on the table behind him. She told me to help him walk to that chair like a man, not a hog. And I'm doing the best I can, Reverend. The rest is up to you. He got up from the chair and came toward me. He peered at me intently, his face showing pain and confusion. He stopped at arm's distance from me, and I could smell in his clothes the sweat from his preaching. You think you educated? I went to college. But what did you learn? To teach reading, writing, and arithmetic, Reverend. What did you learn about your people? What did you learn about her round there? He said, gesturing toward the other room, trying to keep his voice down. I didn't answer him. No, you not educated, boy, he said, shaking his head. You're far from being educated. You learned your reading, writing, and arithmetic, but you don't know nothing. You don't even know yourself. Well, you're doing the talking, Reverend. And the educated boy, he said, thumping his chest. I'm the one that's educated. I know people like you look down on people like me, but, he touched his chest again, I'm the one that's educated. He stared at me as if he could not make up his mind whether to hit me or scream. Grief, oh grief, he muffled his cry. When will you cease? Oh, when? He drew a deep breath, then he began to speak faster. When they had nothing else but grief, where was the release? None. None till he rose. And he said, there's relief from grief across the river. And she believed, and there was relief from grief. Do you know what I'm trying to say to you, boy? I hear you talking, Reverend. You hear me talking, but are you listening? No, you ain't listening. His eyes examined me from the top of my head to my chest, and I could see the rage in his face, see his mouth trembling. He was doing all he could to control his voice so that the others back in the kitchen would not hear him. I won't let you send that boy's soul to hell, he said. I'll fight you with all the strength I have left in this body, and I'll win. You don't have to fight me, Reverend, I told him. You can have him all to yourself. I don't even have to go back up there if that's what you want. You going back, he said, nodding his bald head and still trying hard to control his voice. You owe her as much as I owe her, and long as I can stand on my feet, I owe her and all the others every ounce of my being, and you do too. I don't owe anybody anything, Reverend, I said, and turned toward the window. I felt his hand gripping my shoulder and pulling me around to face him. Don't you turn your back on me, boy. My name is Grant, I said. When you act educated, I'll call you Grant. I'll even call you Mr. Grant when you act like a man. His hand still grasped my shoulder, and I needed all my willpower to keep from knocking it off. He could see what I was thinking, and he slowly released his grip and brought his hand to his side. You think you're the only one that ever felt this way? He asked. You think I never felt this way? You think she never felt this way? Every last one of them back there, one time in their life, wanted to give up. She wanted to give up now. You know that? You got any idea how sick she is? Soon after he go, she's going too. I won't give her another year. I want her to believe he'll be up there waiting for her. And you can help me do it. And you're the only one. How? Tell him to fall down on his knees before he walked to that chair. Tell him to fall down on his knees for her. You're the only one he'll listen to. He won't listen to me. No, I said. I won't tell him to kneel. I'll tell him to listen to you, but I won't tell him to kneel. I will try to help him stand. You think a man can't kneel and stand? It hasn't helped me. The minister drew back from me. His head was shining. So was his face. I could see his mouth working as though he wanted to say something but didn't know how to say it. You just lost, he said. That's all you just lost. Yes, sir, I'm lost. Like most men, I'm lost. Not all men, he said. Me, I'm found. Then you're one of the lucky ones, Reverend. And I won't let you lose his soul in hell. I want him in heaven as much as you do, Reverend. A place you can't believe in. No, I don't believe in it, Reverend. And how can you tell him to believe in it? I'll never tell him not to believe in it. And suppose he asks you if it's there, then what? Suppose he write on that tablet you give him, is it there? Then what? I'll tell him I don't know. You're the teacher. Yes, but I was taught to teach reading, writing, and arithmetic, not the gospel. I Tell him I heard it was there, but I don't know. And suppose he asks you if you believe in heaven, then what? I hope he doesn't, Reverend. Suppose he do. I hope he doesn't. You couldn't say yes. No, Reverend, I couldn't say yes. I couldn't lie to him at this moment. I will never tell him another lie, no matter what. Not for her sake. No, sir. The minister nodded his bald head and grunted to himself. His dark brown eyes in that tired, weary face continued to stare back at me. You think you educated, but you not. You think you're the only person ever had to lie? You think I never had to lie? I don't know, Reverend. Yes, you know. You know all right. That's why you look down on me, because you know I lie. At wakes, at funerals, at weddings, yes, I lie. I lie at wakes and funerals to relieve pain, because reading, writing, and arithmetic is not enough. You think that's all they sent you to school for? They sent you to school to relieve pain, to relieve hurt, and if you have to lie to do it, then you lie. You lie, and you lie, and you lie. When you tell yourself you're feeling good, when you're sick, you lying. When you tell other people you're feeling well, and when you're feeling sick, you lying. You tell them that because they have pain too, and you don't want to add yours, and you lie. She's been lying every day of her life, your aunt in there. That's how you got through that university. Cheating herself here, cheating herself there, but always telling you she's all right. I've seen her hands bleed from picking cotton. I've seen the blisters from the hoe and the cane knife. At that church, crying on her knees. You never looked at the scabs on her knees, boy. Of course you never. Because she never wanted you to see it. And that's the difference between me and you, boy. That makes me the educated one and you the gump. I know my people. I know what they gone through. I know they done cheated themselves, lied to themselves, hoping that one they all love and trust can come back and help relieve the pain.
Chapter 28. I went into the cell with a paper bag full of baked sweet potatoes. The deputy locked the heavy door behind me. How's it going, partner? Jefferson nodded. How do you feel? I'm all right. I brought you a little something. Jefferson was sitting on the bunk with his hands clasped together. I put the bag beside him on the bunk and sat down. I could hear the radio on the floor against the wall playing a sad cowboy song. I saw the notebook and the pencil on the floor next to the radio. This was my first visit since I had given him the notebook and pencil, and I could see that the lead on the pencil was worn down to the wood. I could also see that he had used the eraser a lot. We were quiet a while. Hungry? I asked. Maybe later. I see you've been writing. He didn't answer. Personal, or can I look at it? It ain't nothing. Do you mind? I asked. If you want. I got the notebook and came back to the bunk. The fellow on the radio was saying what a beautiful day it was in Baton Rouge. Jefferson had filled three-quarters of the first page. The letters were large and awkward, the way someone would write who could barely see. He had written across the lines instead of above them. He had used the eraser so much that in some places the paper was worn through. Nothing was capitalized, and there were no punctuation marks. The letters were thin at the beginning and became broader as the lead was worn down. As closely as I could figure, he had written, "I dreamt it again last night." There was taking me somewhere. I wasn't crying. I wasn't begging. I was just going with them. Then I woke up. I couldn't get back to sleep. I didn't want to go back to sleep. I didn't want to dream no more. The was a lot of erasing. And then he wrote, "If I ain't nothing but a hog, how come they just don't knock me in the head like a hog? Starb me like a dog. Starb me like a hog." More erasing then. "Man walks on 2 foot, hogs on 4 hooves. The last couple of words were barely visible, because the lead had been worn down all the way to the wood. I read it over a second time before closing the notebook. I didn't know what to say to him. He was staring at the wall, his hands clasped together. "Do you want me to bring you a pencil sharpener?" I asked after a while. "The little ones you hold in your hand?" "If you can find one." "I'm sure I can," I said. "You know, Paul would have sharpened this pencil for you. He wouldn't mind." Jefferson had unclasped his hands now, and he was scraping the ends of his left fingernails with the index finger of his right hand. His fingernails were hard and purplish. "When's Easter?" he asked. "Tomorrow's Good Friday." "That's when he rose?" "No. He rose on Easter." "That's when he died," Jefferson said to himself. "Never said a mumbling word." "That's right, not a word." "Did you talk to Reverend Ambrose when he came to visit you?" I asked Jefferson. "Some. You ought to talk to him. It's good for your nanan. She wants you to talk to him. He told me to pray." "Do you?" "No. It would be good for your nanan." He looked at me. His eyes were large and sad and reddened. "You think I'm going to heaven?" he asked. "I don't know." "You think Mr. Grope went to heaven?" "You think Brother and Bear went to heaven?" "I don't know." "Then what am I going to pray for?" "For your nan-nan." "Nan-nan don't need me to help her get to heaven. She'll make it if it's up there." "She wants you there with her, where there's no pain and no sorrow." He grinned at me, a brief cynical grin. "You pray, Mr. Wiggins?" "No, Jefferson, I don't," he grunted. "But then I'm lost, Jefferson," I said, looking at him closely. "At this moment, I don't believe in anything, like your nan-nan does, like Reverend Ambrose does, and like I want you to believe. I want you to believe so that maybe one day I will. In heaven, Mr. Wiggins." "If it helps others down here on earth, Jefferson." "Reverend Ambrose says I have to give up what's down here. Say there ain't nothing down here on earth for me, no more." He meant possessions, Jefferson. Cars, money, clothes, things like that. "You ever see me with a car, Mr. Wiggins?" "No." "With more than a dollar in my pocket?" "No." "More than 2 pair of shoes, Mr. Wiggins. One for Sunday, one for working in." "No, Jefferson." "Then what on earth I got to give up, Mr. Wiggins?" "You've never had any possessions to give up, Jefferson. But there's something greater than possessions, and that is love. I know you love her and would do anything for her. Didn't you eat all the gumbo when you weren't hungry, just to please her? That's all we're asking for now, Jefferson. Do something to please her." "What about me, Mr. Wiggins? What people done to please me?" "Hasn't she done many things to please you, Jefferson? Cooked for you, washed for you, taken care of you when you were sick?" "She's sick now, Jefferson, and she's asking for only one thing in this world. Walk like a man. Meet her up there." "Y'all asking a lot, Mr. Wiggins, from a poor old nigger who never had nothing." "She would do it for you." "She go to that chair for me, Mr. Wiggins?" "You? Anybody?" He waited for me to answer him. I wouldn't. "No, Mr. Wiggins, I gotta go myself. Just me. Just me, Mr. Wiggins. Reverend Ambrose said God'd be there if I asked him." "You think he'd be there if I asked him, Mr. Wiggins?" "That's what they say, Jefferson." "You believe in God, Mr. Wiggins?" "Yes, Jefferson, I believe in God." "How?" "I think it's God that makes people care for people, Jefferson. I think it's God makes children play and people sing. I think it's God that brings loved ones together. I believe it's God that makes trees bud and food grow out of the earth." "Who make people kill people, Mr. Wiggins?" "They killed his son, Jefferson." And he never said a mumbling word. "That's what they say." "That's how I want to go, Mr. Wiggins. Not a mumbling word." Another cowboy song was playing on the radio, but it was quiet and not disturbing. I could hear inmates down the cell block calling to one another. Jefferson sat forward on the bunk, his big hands clasped together again. I still had the notebook. I started to open it, but changed my mind. You need anything, Jefferson?
No, I don't need anything, Mr. Wiggins.
Reverend Ambrose says I don't need nothing down here no more.
I'll get you that sharpener, I said. I ain't got nothing more to say, Mr. Wiggins.
I'm sure you have.
I hope the time just hurries up and gets here. Cut out all this waiting.
I wish I knew what to do, Jefferson.
I'm the one who got to do everything, Mr. Wiggins. I'm the one.
He got up from the bunk and went to the window and looked up at the buds on the higher branches of the sycamore tree. Through the branches of the tree I could see the sky, blue and lovely and clear. "You Are My Sunshine" was playing on the radio. Jefferson turned his back to the window and looked at me.
Me, Mr. Wiggins, me. Me to take the cross. Your cross. Nan-Nan's cross. My own cross. Me, Mr. Wiggins. This old stumbling nigger. Y'all ask a lot.
He went to the cell door and grasped it with both hands. He started to jerk on the door, but changed his mind and turned back to look at me.
Whoever carried my cross, Mr. Wiggins? My mama? My daddy? They dropped me when I wasn't nothing. Still don't know who they were at this minute. I went into the field when I was 6, driving that old water cart. I done pulled that cotton sack. I done cut cane, load cane, swung that axe, chopped ditch banks since I was 6.
He's standing over me now.
Yes, I'm yeoman, Mr. Wiggins.
But nobody didn't know that for now. Cuss for nothing, beat for nothing, work for nothing, grin to get by. Everybody thought that's how it's supposed to be.
You too, Mr. Wiggins. You never thought I was nothing else.
I didn't either. Thought I was doing what the Lord had put me on this earth to do. He went to the window and turned to look at me.
Now all y'all want me to be better than everybody else.
How, Mr. Wiggins? You tell me.
I don't know, Jefferson.
What I got left, Mr. Wiggins? 2 weeks?
I think it's something like that, if nothing happens.
Nothing gonna happen, Mr. Wiggins.
And it ain't something like that.
That's all I got on this here earth.
I gotta face that, Mr. Wiggins. It's all right for y'all to say something like that. For me, it's that. That. That's all.
And like Reverend Ambrose said, then I'll have to give up this old earth.
But ain't that where I'm going, Mr. Wiggins? Back in the earth?
My head down, I didn't answer him.
You can look at me, Mr. Wiggins. I don't mind. I raised my head, and I saw him standing there under the window, big and tall, and not as stooped as he had been in chains.
I'm going to do my best, Mr. Wiggins. That's all I can promise, my best.
You are more a man than I am, Jefferson.
"'Cause I'm going to go die soon? That make me a man, Mr. Wiggins.
My eyes were closed before this moment, Jefferson. My eyes have been closed all my life.
Yes, we all need you, every last one of us.
He studied me a while. Then he turned his back and looked up at the window.
So pretty out there, he said. So pretty.
I ain't never seen it so pretty.
I looked at him standing there big and tall, his broad back toward me.
What's going to be like, Mr. Wiggins?
I thought I knew what he was talking about, but I didn't answer him.
He turned around to face me.
What's it going to feel like, Mr. Wiggins?
I shook my head. I felt my eyes burning.
I hope it ain't long.
It's not long, Jefferson, I said.
How do you know, Mr. Wiggins?
I read it.
I was not looking at him. I was looking at the wall. It had been in the newspaper.
The first jolt, if everything is right, immediately knocked a person unconscious.
He came back and sat down on the bunk.
I'm all right, Mr. Wiggins.
I nodded without looking at him.
Care for a tato, Mr. Wiggins?
He asked, opening the paper bag.
Sure, I said.
Chapter 29, Jefferson's Diary. Mr. Wiggin, you say write something, but I don't know what to write. And you say I must be thinking about things I ain't telling nobody, and I ought to put it on paper, but I don't know what to put on paper, because I never wrote nothing but homework. I never wrote a letter in all my life, because Nana used to get other children to write a letter and read a letter for, not me. So I can't think of too much to say, but maybe next time. It's evening, and I done eat my rice and beans, and I done had my cup of milk, and the sun coming in the window, because I can see it splashing on the floor, and I can hear Ned and them talking, and that's about all for now. I couldn't sleep last night because I kept dreaming it, and I don't want to dream it, because I'm just walking to somewhere, but I don't know where it's at, and before I get to the door, I wake up. And I want to write in the tablet last night, but you ain't got no light in you but the moon, so I'm writing this morning as soon as sun up, and now I done forgot what I want to say. Nana brought me some Easter egg, and I ate one, and Nana ate one, and Reverend Ambrose, he ate one, and Reverend Ambrose asked me if I know why the Lord died, and he say he died for me so I can meet him in heaven, and all he want me to do is say I want to be up there with him and the angels, and say if I mean it with all my heart and soul, I'll go to heaven. And Nana start crying again, and Miss Lou got to hug her. And Nana say, all I need to do to make her life worth living is ask the Lord forgive me and to pardon of my sin. And her and Reverend Ambrose was on their knee, and Miss Lou was still in the chair hugging her. And I was glad when Paul come and got me. I don't know what day it is, but last night I couldn't sleep. And I could hear Ned down the way snoring, and I laid there and thought about Samson saying, if the Lord love me, how come he let my wife die and leave me with them cheering? And how come he don't come here and take away people like them Matin brothers on the St. Charles River instead of messing with poor old folks who ain't never done nothing but try and do all they know how to serve him? It looked like the Lord just worked for white folks. Because ever since I was nothing but a little boy, I've been on my own hauling water to the field in that old water cart with all them dime buckets and that dipper just hitting and old Dorothy just trotting and trotting and me up there hitting her with that rope and all them dime buckets and that dipper just hitting and hitting against that bowl of water so I can get the people their food and their water on time. And the people see me and drop their hoe and come get their bucket because they know their string or their mark on the top. And Boo sitting under a bloodweed with his white beans and rice and going, where he at? Where he at this here very minute? And how come he don't give a man a little breeze if he's so merciful? And Miss Rachel with her rice and greens saying, keep it up. Just keep it up and see if a clap of lightning don't come there and knock the fool out of you. And Boo saying, let him. I don't care. Because a dead nigger is better off than a live one any weekday. And Sadie, I'm getting drunk and say it again. And Sadie standing in the middle of the road, hauling up in the air, saying, come on and get me, come on and get me, see if I care. And falling down in the ditch, and rolling out in the road, and holding up the bottle so the Lord could see it. And rolling back in the ditch, and rolling back in the road, and drinking, and holding the bottle up so the Lord could see it. And saying, I know you don't love nobody but white folks, because you ain't God, not mine. And come on, and throw your lightning if you want, because no nigger ain't got no God. And the church-going people closing their doors and windows to keep from hearing Boo blaspheming the Lord. But me and the rest of the cheering in the corner like Boo, because he always bought us candy and cake. I just can't sleep no more, because every time I shut my eyes, I see that door, and before I get there, I wake up, and I don't go back to sleep. Because I don't want to walk to that door no more. Because I don't know what back of there. If it's where they're going to put that chair. Or if it's supposed to mean death or the grave or heaven. I don't know. I wonder if Boo went to heaven. Because I know he didn't get religion first. Mr. Wiggin, you say you like what I got here. But you say you still can't give me an A. Just a B. Because you say I ain't gone deep in me yet. And you know I can if I try hard. And when I ask you what you mean deep in me, you say, just say what's on my mind. So one day you can be saved and you can save the cheering. And I say, I don't know what you mean. And you say, I do know what you mean. And you look so tired sometimes, Mr. Wiggin. I just feel like telling you I like you. But I don't know how to say this. Because I ain't never say it to nobody before. And nobody ain't never say it to me. I know I care for Nannin, but I don't know if love is care. Because cutting wood and hauling water and things like that, I don't know if that's love or just work to do. And you say that's love. But you say, you know I got more than just that to say. When I lay there at night and can't sleep, I try and think what you mean I got more. Because I ain't done this much thinking and this much writing in all my life before. It's Monday. And I ain't got but just a few days left. And I hope I see my Nannin just one more time. Because Miss Lou and Reverend Ambrose say she ain't faring too good and couldn't make it with them this time. But the Lord know, Mr. Wiggin, I hope I can see her one more time on this earth before I go. Is that love, Mr. Wiggin, when you want to see somebody bad, bad? Mr. Wiggin, thank you for saying I'm doing B-plus work, and you know the A ain't too far. The sheriff and Mr. Picho and Mr. Morgan come in the cell today. And Mr. Picho asked me how I'm doing. And I tell him I'm doing all right. And he say yes, he can see I'm all right. And he asks me if he can do something for me. And I tell him, no, sir, I'm all right. And he asks if I want a brand new pencil with a penny erase on it. And I told him I would take the pencil, but I don't need the erase, because you told me to just put down anything come in my head. And if it ain't right, just scratch over it and go on. And he say yes, he can see that. And he asked me if I want him to sharpen my pencil. And I said, yes, sir. And he sharpened the pencil on a teeny pearl-handled knife. And I look at the knife, and I see Mr. Picho look up at Sheriff Geary and Mr. Morgan, and the sheriff looked back at him, but Mr. Morgan never stopped looking at me like he's trying to figure me. Now, Mr. Picho asked me if I want the little knife. And I tell him, yes, sir, I didn't mind. And he unhooked a little gold chain from his belt lope and handed me the knife and the chain, and he said it was all mine. And I say, just for a few days, and you can have it back. And I held the little knife in my hand and the chain in my other hand and just look at it. And I hear Mr. Picho say, well. And I hear Mr. Morgan say, it ain't Friday yet. And Mr. Picho say, you want double that bet? You want to add that trotter? And Mr. Morgan say, it still ain't Friday yet. Old Clark been coming around, too, trying to act like a human. But I can see in his face he ain't no good. And I don't even look at him when he asks me if I'm doing all right and can he get me something. No, I just go on writing in my tablet. And I don't care if he do see it after I'm dead and gone. Paul trying to be hard when he ain't. Like he don't want to get too close to me no more. And all the time, he's the only one around here know how to talk like a human to people. I know you, Paul. And I know old Clark, and I know you too, Sheriff Geary, and you too, Mr. Picho, and Mr. Morgan, and all the rest of y'all. I just never say none of this before, but I know y'all, every last one of y'all. Lord have mercy, sweet Jesus, Mr. Wiggin, where all them people come from? When you asked me if some cheering can come up here and speak to me, I didn't know you was meaning all them cheering in your class. And just sitting there on the floor, all quiet, in their clean clothes, looking at me. And I could see some were scared of me. But most was brave and spoke. And my little cousin Estelle even come up and kissed me on the jaw. And I couldn't hold back no more. Then after the cheering, here come the old folks. It looked like everybody from the quarter was here. Miss Julia, and Joe, and Miss Harriet, and Aunt Agnes, and Mr. Noman. And Miss Sarah, and Miss Lilia, and Mr. Harry, and Miss Lena, and God know who all. And Mr. Ophel, and Miss Felia with the beads, and just praying, and all the people saying how good I look, and Lord have mercy, sweet Jesus, Mr. Wiggin, how you got back here in that suit? That suit looked like it half box size, because I remember Miss Rita got him that suit way back 10-11 years back. And Bach babbing there like he know me, and Miss Rita saying he want to say he glad to see me, and he want to give me one of his Aggies. And me just looking at Bach, shaking my head and shaking my head, and I can't stop saying, oh, Bach, oh, Bach, oh, Bach, you want to give me one of your Aggies? But old Bach wouldn't turn it loose till Miss Rita had to tell him, let go, Bach, a few times. And still Bach wouldn't turn loose till Miss Rita pried out his hand and handed it to me. And Bach started babbing there till Miss Rita had to reach out her hand for me to give it back to her. and she give it back to Bach, and Bach put it back in his pocket and start rattling it with all the others in there. And Miss Rita say she was sure he wanted to give me something. That's why he wanted to come. And I told her it was all right. I didn't need nothing. But she say Bach wouldn't rest tonight if he didn't give me something. And she told him to give me a different one if he didn't want to give me the Aggie. And old Bach, looking way over yonder, kept rattling the marbles in his pocket and just kept on looking way over yonder, rattling the marbles till he found the little one he had in his pocket. And hand me that. This was the first time I cried when they locked the door behind me, the very first time. And I just sat on my bunk crying, but not let them see or hear me, because I didn't want them to think wrong. But I was crying because of Bach and the marble he gave me, and because of the people come to see me, because they hadn't never done nothing like that for me before. I don't want to sleep at night no more. Just catnap in the day while they got light and they got noise. Because I don't want to dream about that door every time I shut my eyes. When they brought me in the room and I seen Nannin at the table, I seen how old she looked and how tired she looked. I told her I love her, and I told her I was strong. And she just looked old and tired and pulled me to her and kissed me. And it was the first time she never done that. And it felt good, and I let her hold me long as she won't. Because you say it was good for her. And I told her I was strong, and she didn't need to come back no more, because I was strong. And she just sat there with her eyes most shut, like she wanted to go to sleep, looking at me all the time till Reverend and Miss Lou have to help her up and take her back home. Mr. Wiggin, when I see your girlfriend and y'all together, I see how pretty she is, and I'm sorry how I talked that day when I was mad at you and say them nasty thing about her. Because she's so pretty and smiles so pretty when she look at people. And you can see she ain't putting on airs. And it's just quality in her. And she talks so nice to people. And all the time I want to look at her, but scared to, because she's so pretty and I'm so ugly. And she got on a pretty dress with pretty flowers. And my clothes don't smell good. And I ain't took a bath since Saturday. I still want to look at her. And she say she think I'm looking good and strong. And when she put a hand on my shoulder, I start trembling. And she leaned close and kissed me. And I feel hot, and I could smell her powder scent. And I feel good and scared and hot, because that's the first lady that pretty ever touched me. And nobody that pretty never kissed me. And when y'all left, I come to the door, and I look at her long, long as I could. And I could smell her powder scent and still feel her mouth on my face. I'm sorry I cry, Mr. Wiggin. I'm sorry I cry when you say you ain't coming back tomorrow. I'm strong. And Rev Ambrose going to be with me. And Mr. Hare coming too. And reason I cry, because you've been so good to me, Mr. Wiggin. And nobody ain't never been that good to me. And make me think I'm somebody. Sheriff Geary asked me what I want for my supper, and I told him I want Nannin to cook me some okra and rice, and some pork chop, and a cornbread, and some clammer. And he say he gonna see what he can do, and say what I want for dessert. And I told him just a little ice cream in a cup and a moon pie. They took me and let me stand under the shower with a new bar of soap, and they gave me a big white clean towel and brought me back. And I put on some clean clothes and sat down because my food was here. And I ate it, every bit. And it was the best meal I know my Nannin ever cooked. Sun going down. And I know this is the last one I'm going to ever see. But I'm going to see one more sunrise, because I ain't going to sleep tonight. I'm going to sleep a long time after tomorrow. Chef Geary come by after I ate. And asked me how I'm doing. And I say, I'm doing all right. And he asked me, he say, I never pick up your tablet and look at it. And he asked me what all I've been writing. And I told him, just things. And he say, ain't he done treat me right? And I told him, yes, sir. And he say, ain't his deputies done treat me fair? And I told him, yes, sir. And he say, Ain't he done let people visit me any time? And I say, yes, sir. And he say, didn't he let the children and all the people from the quarter come and visit me just 2 days ago? And I say, yes, sir. And he say, is you going to put that in your tablet? And I say, yes, sir. And he say, good. Put that down in your tablet. I treat you good all the time you've been here. And he say, he had to go home because he hadn't had his supper yet. But for me to call a deputy if I need something. And then he asked me if I want the light to stay on all night in case I want to write some more. And I told him, yes, sir. And he say, all right, I can have all the light I want. My light on, but there ain't no more light on in the place. And the place is quiet, quiet, but nobody's sleeping. They got a moon out there, and I can see the leaves on the tree. But I ain't going to see no more leaves after tomorrow. I don't know if they got a heaven, because Samson say they can't be. And Boo say they ain't none for no nigger. But Reverend Ambrose say there is one for all men, and Bach don't know. I've been shaking and shaking, but I'm going to stay strong. I ain't had no business going with their brother and bear, because they ain't no good, and I'm going to be meeting them soon. It's quiet, quiet, and I can hear my teeth hitting, and I can hear my heart. When I was a little boy, I was a water boy and rode the cart, and now I got to be a man and sat in a chair. Don't know if you can read this, Mr. Wiggin. My hand shaking, and I can hear my heart. I can hear Randy, but I ain't listening no more, because he for the living and not for me. It's late, and I don't know what time it is, but I know it's late. And I just went to the toilet, and I just washed my face. Day breaking. Sun coming up. The bird in the tree sound like a bluebird. Sky blue. Blue, Mr. Wiggin. Goodbye, Mr. Wiggin. Tell them I'm strong. Tell them I'm a man. Goodbye, Mr. Wiggin. I'm going to ask Paul if he can bring you this. Sincerely, Jefferson.
Chapter 30. Sidney DeRogers was on his way to George Giroux's house to mow the lawn when the truck went by him. He didn't pay any close attention to the black truck with the gray tarpaulin cover, but he would tell the people later at the Rainbow Club that he did feel a cold chill when the truck went by. The truck turned left on the main street 2 blocks up ahead of Sidney, but he thought it was just another truck delivering something at one of the department stores. Around 11 o'clock, George Giroux's wife, Lucy, came out into the yard where Sidney was raking up the grass and leaves and told him that she wanted him to go uptown to Edwin's department store and get her a large spool of white thread. Sidney drove the 6 blocks in Lucy's car, and as he was approaching the store, he saw a crowd of people standing on the sidewalk facing the courthouse. Parked beside the courthouse was the same truck that Sidney had seen at 8 o'clock that morning. The tarpaulin had been rolled back, and 2 men sat at the tail end of the truck, talking and smoking cigarettes. Sidney parked a little distance beyond the department store and walked back. He saw many people he knew, both white and colored, but no one paid him any attention. They were too concerned with the truck parked beside the courthouse. When Sidney came into the store, he found all the clerks up at the front, trying to see what was going on in the truck. He stood back waiting, but no one paid him any attention. Finally, he told one of the women that Miss Lucy had sent him up there for a spool of coarse white thread. Without looking around, the woman told him to go and find it himself. When he came back to pay her, she told him to have Lucy send the money some other time. My aunt did not sleep at the house the night before. Like many of the other older people in the quarter, she spent the night with Miss Emma. Some of the others took shifts, but my aunt stayed there the whole night. Reverend Ambrose was still there until midnight. Then he went home to get some sleep because the sheriff had told him he wanted all witnesses at the courthouse no later, absolutely no later, than 11:30 the next morning. Vivian and I sat in a corner of the Rainbow Club that night. There were more than a dozen people in the place, but it was quieter than I had ever seen it. Vivian held on to her one drink all the time she was there, and when she left, she still had not finished it. She had gone to church after her class that afternoon, and she told me that she would go again the next morning. She told me that from noon until she heard, she would have her students on their knees beside their desks. She left the Rainbow Club at 9. After walking to the car and kissing her goodnight, I went back inside and stood at the bar. Claiborne wiped glasses and did not talk to anybody. He served you when you raised your glass for another drink or your bottle for another beer. Then he went back to wiping glasses. Thelma had closed up the cafe just after 9 and gone home. Claiborne said he was going to close up at 11 tonight. I told him I wanted a half pint to take with me. Claiborne wrapped it in a brown paper bag and I paid him, but we didn't look directly at each other. At 10:30 I left, but I still didn't want to go home, and I drove to a bar in Port Allen. I ran into a guy there who knew me and wanted to talk about it, but I didn't want to talk about it, and after I had a drink I started back for the quarter. I got back there about midnight. The place was pitch black except for the light on Miss Emma's porch. A couple of cars I didn't recognize were parked in front of the house. I suppose they were family or friends who had come to be with her tonight. I didn't stop. There was nothing more to say. I went on home. I took the bottle out of the paper bag and drank about half of it. I had bought the liquor to make me sleep, but God knows now I didn't want to sleep. I didn't want to dream. Not tonight. The minister did not sleep at all that night, and at daybreak he got up and knelt beside his bed to say his prayers. Then he went to the kitchen to warm water for his bath. His wife, Mrs. Becky, came into the kitchen to fix him a bowl of kush-kush for his breakfast. When the minister finished his bath, he sat down at the table to eat. He had a cup of coffee before he ate his food. He ate very slowly as he sat at the table thinking about what he had to do today. After he finished his breakfast, he went into the bedroom to get his Bible. Then he came back into the kitchen and sat down at the table again. He had chosen the 23rd Psalm to read at the jail. He made that choice soon after the sheriff had given him permission to be one of the witnesses. Now he was reading his Bible and praying that God would give him the strength that he knew he needed. He had never witnessed anything like this before, and he knew he needed God every moment that he would be there. He knew that Harry Williams was going to be there too, and he told himself he would stand or sit as close to Harry as he could. He also reminded himself that he would meet Lecox soon after it was over. Lecox was the colored mortician of Bayonne, and he would have the coffin ready.
That's all the time we have for today's readings from Ernest Gaines, A Lesson Before Dying. Join us at the same time next week. Thanks again for listening. If you know someone who could benefit from our service, point them in our direction. If you know someone who would like to contribute in any way, point them in our direction. You can call us at 919-832-5138 or visit our website at triangleReadingService.org. I will repeat both of those at the end of this broadcast. Once again, I'm Kirk Benrood. Our readers, Tom Haynes, Pam Vesper, Robbie Merritt, Awen Fulton, and Dan and Julie Oliver, thank you for listening. The music was supplied by Joni Madden of the Irish-American band Cherish the Ladies. Our phone number once again is 919-832-5138. Our web address once again is triangleReadingService.org.